technology. Hi, this is Michelle Anderson, and I'm here at the Elm Tree Restaurant in Holton with gubernatorial candidate Bill Beardsley. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Hi, Michelle. It's great being here.
So, let's start with this. Why would I want to vote for Bill Beardsley for governor?
Well, I love the state. I've accomplished a lot at Husson over the last 23 years, taking it from near bankruptcy to prosperity. And I want to transform the state the way I transformed Husson. I look at the potential this state has. I mean, it's the same size as the country of Ireland, 32,000 square miles. And you just see this tremendous potential. We've got the largest forest the east of the Mississippi. We've got 3,500 miles of shore frontage, and our seaports are you know, half a day closer by container ship to the European ports of London or Rotterdam than the seaports of Baltimore, New York. So it's this tremendous potential. And I was a vice president of Bangor Hydro back in the old days, and our electric rates were no different than the rest of the nation. Today, they're 50% higher. And it just seems that our government has lost touch with the economy of Maine. Not just the people of Maine, but the economy of Maine. And they've closed Maine Yankee. They've torn out or sold off these low-cost hydroelectric plants. I mean, we still have them, but they belong to Florida Power and Light and things like that. And somehow, we've got to get the government back in sync with the people's needs and the business needs. So it's somebody that's got that kind of experience and has been successful. I've been a chief executive officer. When I went to Husson, things were pretty tough, and I had to approve every requisition of over $5 until things got straightened out. I had to work with the faculty and work with the staff and hire good quality people, and had an opportunity to bring in Susan Collins to be our founding director of the Center for Family Business, and people, and bring in good quality faculty, and we grew. We kept our tuition very low. We start our budget process each year by saying, what can the students afford? What can the lower income Maine students afford? And that's what we've got. It's not based on what we want or what we need. It's what the students can afford.
As governor, are you going to be able to, you have that sort of leeway to do the same sort of thing?
Well, basically, you've got a bully pulpit as a governor. You've also got to deal with the legislature, with the budget. But I think if you really raise the issues of how much money we have, I would say, what can our taxpayers afford? What can small businesses afford for taxes? What can the larger businesses? Because that's what's driving us out. Our taxes are across the board much higher than the national average in terms of the percentage of our income. And our family income is between 75 and 80% of the national income, and it's beginning to go down. It's coming, continuing to go down. So we're getting in worse shape compared to other states. And I think when that's made clear, and people are aware that I will make that clear to the public, then I think the legislature will be sensitive to the position that we've got to reduce taxes. And I've signed the pledge to not have an increase in taxes. And I am committed to lowering our taxes to the national average, and not by smoke and mirrors, not by shifting the tax burden from the state to the town. At the same time, there are little things that happen that people don't pay much attention to. For instance, we have this business equipment tax reimbursement program, which is a wonderful program that should attract businesses to Maine and attract local people to increase their investments. But they're afraid to do it because every year we change it. I mean, this last year, we voted in that we were going to reduce that benefit to only 90%. We have a tax exemption, sales tax exemption for big industry for electricity. But it changes. It was 95% exemption, now it's 85%. And it's those little death by a thousand slashes that really challenges it. So my feeling is by making that public knowledge, the legislature and the governor should be able to pull together. And I'm certainly hoping that we'll have a Republican Senate and a Republican House, and that would really make it a lot easier to make those kinds of things. But whatever, we work together. And so my feeling is you have good, clear information, and you take those stands and threaten to veto if some bill comes through that exceeds what we can afford.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, much of my audience is from Northern Maine, and we have, well, as you know, we have some different issues than maybe Southern Maine. Do you know anything about this bill that Henry Joyce put in?
Well, Henry basically wants to have the real Maine, and then what, Northern Massachusetts is another state, and I certainly sympathize with that. I've done some research that really show that land ownership and everything in the northern part of the state is very different. We have less than 20 people per square mile. You could also divide it. If you look north-south and you go from Baffin Island down to South America on the longitude, that all of eastern Maine, east of the Kennebec, should be in the Atlantic time zone. So I suppose you could call it the Atlantic state. But I prefer Henry's option. And I think he's just challenging people. I mean, the family incomes in Piscataquis and Washington County are, 20-30% below the family incomes in Sagadahoc and Cumberland. That's a big, big difference. The population density is much smaller, and we're natural resource based. I mean, the best jobs are jobs in the forest industry and natural resources, and we need to fight, and we have the opportunity to. But when the votes will say they have an effect on insecticides, and we come up with insecticide standards that are the highest in the world, it just cripples our ability to produce potatoes. My feeling is I'm all for having good environmental protection, but if you look, it's been insecticides, it's been a variety of new types of grains and stuff that have ended starvation. I mean, Michelle, when you and I were kids, India and China and places like that were starving to death. Now they're being fed. I mean, there's some problems where the distribution system's broken down. And we've got that natural resource. We've got this large forest potential. We've got the industries in place. And you talk about job creation. I made my announcement at Pleasant River Lumber over in Dover Foxtrot. They have 80 employees. If they add one employee, there's a multiplier effect, and there'll be four jobs added out in the community. It's a huge multiplier effect. So if you look at paper mills, the whole forest industry has this huge multiplier compared to, say, a service industry or a call center, which has a very small multiplier effect. So you're leveraging your investment tremendously if you can invest. And the problem is that if it goes the other way and you lose a sawmill job or a paper mill job, there's a negative ripple effect. So my feeling is we've got to be extremely attentive to that and persuade people to invest in Maine.
Well, with the environmentalists trying to take things over, and with the federal government and all of these people who want the land up here, they all want control of the land. Is there a way that we can encourage that sort of industry anymore?
Certainly, yes. I mean, it is private land, it's private property. I mean, that's what our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, Fifth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, say you have a right to this. I think a lot of our people that call themselves environmentalists are really much more interested in getting rid of private land. I've had them tell me that they don't need to win a referendum, they don't need to win a lawsuit, they don't need to pass a bill. All they need to do is create uncertainty, risk, and delay. And the family business will hesitate to invest. The big corporation will hesitate to invest. We saw what happened at the Big A Dam. We saw what happened at Plum Creek. It happens all the time in small businesses. I don't consider that activity environmental at all. I consider that anti-business or socialistic, or people that are elitists that want to soak Maine in forest and formaldehyde and put a sign over it that says, look, but don't touch. And it really irks me because they've tried to run away with, they call it environmentalism. I would say good conservatives are naturally, believe in conservation. I mean, it's all through the Bible on how we care for our land. And you talk to the people that own land, the potato farmers and stuff like that, and they're good stewards. I mean, they care about it. Those dads want to pass it on to their son or daughter. So I think that we need to get rid of the polarization. In my doctoral dissertation, which is up on Township 16, Range 4, dealt with how do you resolve conflicts in multiple-use forest resource management. I'd use an example of the endangered Canadian lynx. I mean,
mean, you talk to biologists and say, why are they endangered? And the biologist will say, because the snowshoe hare has disappeared. Then you go to another biologist and say, why has the snowshoe hare disappeared? And they'll say, because there's no thickets, no undergrowth, no briar patches for Brer Rabbit. See, and then you go to silviculturalists and you say, why? And they say, well, it's because we have sustainable forestry. So we have cut every other tree. We have a canopy overhead, so there's no sunlight gets to the forest floor. So you have a desert and there's no undergrowth. And then you say, well, then what's the solution to that? And the silviculturalist says, well, of course, it's little patchwork quilted clear cuts. And all of a sudden, but you ask the whole question, and people say, we can't have clear cuts. Those are bad. That's industry owners. But if they're really interested in you know, the Canadian lynx, then, and that's what I think a Republican, a conservative, a person that really loves this kind of issue is, you sit down there and you try to work those things through. You connect the dots and get rid of the hyperbole, get rid of the emotion, get rid of the... And I just get so irked when I drive down Route 1. I think down East Main has turned into chilly. I mean, and I don't mean cold. I mean a little narrow strip along Route 1 with 2 miles to the north. There's a fence all along there that says, you know, the Great Maine Woods soaked in formaldehyde, no trespassing, look what don't touch. And they forgot all about our common use of the land and our attitude towards trespass as part of our tradition. And you go a mile or two to the south of Route 1 all the way down there, and they said, you know, kingdoms fenced off, kingdoms by the sea, Maine is not allowed. Well, you know, what's happening is Mainers are being pushed into these, you know, strip malls. And you see the lobster, they're trapped right along Route 1. And I think the solution to that is we got to make sure those lobstermen earn a good living. I mean, you can zone it and say you can keep your land and pass it on without paying taxes. But the deep down inside, what's going to keep young people here in the next generation is helping them find a career. And I've spent 23 years preparing Maine kids for careers. And the reason I'm running for governor is I want to make sure those jobs are in Maine, and particularly northern and eastern and central Maine. I mean, that's the part of Maine that I really love the most. I love it all, but it's...
Great. You know, a while back, and I think, again, it was Henry Joy, there was a bill in the House to try to go to county forms of government, I think in an effort to get rid of LURC and LURC's vast power that it holds over landowners up here. Had you heard anything about that, or have you ever given any thought?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when government experiments, when they try things, that's fine. But if it doesn't work, get rid of it. I mean, that's the difference between the public and private sector. I mean, Derrigo is an unmitigated disaster. But there's nothing to make government get rid of it. And we ought to get rid of it. And LURC, I mean, in theory, they were trying to come up, how do you manage places where you don't have enough people to do it? I think county government is a tremendous mechanism. I think the other thing is the people that oversee LURC and the administrators don't live there. They live somewhere else. So they don't understand the local issues. They don't know how local people would like to resolve those issues. They're blind to history. And the very fact that we had all these, you know, dozens of hunting camps and guide camps around Moosehead Lake and great hotels out on Kineo with, you know, thousands of people coming to visit and trains arriving and all of this kind of stuff. And it's like, oh no, but this is wilderness. Well, I mean, this has not been wilderness for hundreds of years. I mean, there were merino sheep up in most of our forest land. Back, that's where the stone walls and cellar holes came from. They didn't come from little pioneers just doing little vegetable gardens around the trees. We clear-cut everything because of the merino sheep industry. And that stopped about Bangor. And north of there, it always was the Great Maine Woods. South of there, it was open country. That's why Thoreau, back in 1834, when he wrote about Bangor is a star on the edge of the night. Well, he meant it was open country. You know, and the environmentalists have to go back and study. I mean, George Perkins Marsh, one of the founding environmentalists back in 1873 in a book called Man and Nature, said, this property, managing this property, is too valuable to be left in the hands of government. It's got to be left in the private sector. You know, and you kind of say to yourself, I mean, there's a message there that we should be listening to. I mean, government has not done a good job. I led a workshop on sustainable forestry in the Russia Far East, which is kind of north of China, about 12 years ago with Elbridge Cleaves from Danforth and David Carlisle from Bangor and some others. And I remember the night when we were sitting there, and Ivan and all the managers from across Russia were studying sustainable forestry, and Ivan kind of, through an interpreter, says, there's something wrong with this picture. I mean, here, you're coming to us and telling us that you've got all these movements across Maine to have public takeover of all your forests. Well, we've been spending the last decade trying to privatize ours and giving it to the people where it belongs. What's wrong with this picture? Well, you know, I haven't hit it right on the head. I mean, it's too bad you have to go to Russia to get that. But, you know, and I think that this movement, you know, I've done these long-range studies with environmentalists and forest landowners and corporate executives that own forest companies on who's going to own the land in Maine, the forest land, in 2020. In the southern part of the state, it's quite different because the land values are so high. But in the northern part of the state, the conclusion is it's going to stay private. And part of it is that the easement movement, whether you like it or not, but it's a private decision. But the easement movement has taken the wind out of the sails of public ownership. I mean, it really is, it's taken away any that new. So I think there's a smaller and smaller group of these. This newest idea of this, what called the treasured landscape or something like that. I mean, it's like it doesn't belong to anybody. It belongs to people. The reason it's treasured is because private landowners have been managing it. You know, and some of them, Fred Dingley from Lee, Maine, who wrote, you know, about his 500-acre woods and wrote poetry, he wrote a beautiful poem about Borrowed from God. We talked about the farmer going out and working his 500-acre woodlot. And he finally got all his bills paid, got his debt paid, and all that stuff. And he just was so proud of it, and that the earth was his and all that. But in the end, you know, he said, you know, we're managing this for God. We're custodians of that. And I think it's that tradition we've got to preserve. You know, we've got to get people back familiar with what we call a working forest. So,
is that possible to do?
Absolutely. It's a cultural thing. And I think that's why the idea of having counties that control LURC, the kind of subdivide LURC and stuff like that, I mean, it's awfully hard to see, for instance, why the people of Cumberland, York County, can vote on whether or not the Native Americans can have a casino in Washington County, any more than the people of Washington County should control whether or not there's a pier in Portland Harbor. I mean, it's just crazy. And that's why we have a republic, not necessarily a democracy. That's why we have a House and a Senate. When people talk about, let's just consolidate and have a single, unicameral government in Augusta with just a few people. Well, that's a further taking away. I don't see anything wrong with having separate commissioners and separate departments, as long as we're very efficient with those small departments and natural resources, because they have different interests. And I think we ought to have local legislators.